Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Tuesday, President Obama plans to address the nation to gain support for his plan to strike Syria. A number of no-strike on Syria actions have taken place across the country, and at least 50 are scheduled in the coming days. On Tuesday, members of Code Pink sat behind Secretary of State John Kerry as he made his case for a strike. Their hands were painted red, and at one point, Medea Benjamin yelled, "We don't want another war." A possible strike on Syria is getting 24/7 coverage in the national media. In light of what we know from past wars and bombings, what questions should the U.S. media be exploring? Who's keeping the administration accountable? And what about this question? Why is the administration pushing so hard for a strike? Mark Seibel oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondence. His latest piece with his colleague Hana Alam is called "To Some, U.S. Case for Syrian Gas Attack, Strike Has Too Many Holes." And they write, quote, "The Obama administration's public case for attacking Syria is riddled with inconsistencies and hinges mainly on circumstantial evidence, undermining U.S. efforts this week to build support at home and abroad for a punitive strike against Bashar Assad's regime," end quote. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. And yesterday, Walmart workers protested in 15 cities across the country. At least 24 people were arrested. Workers are calling for a living wage and an end to ongoing retaliation, including firings. Many of Walmart's 1.3 million workers are part-time and paid just $8.80 an hour. They're asking for $12 an hour. This action follows the fast food strikes and protests, the largest the industry has ever seen. Joining us to talk about these actions and labor reporting overall is Mike Elk. He's a labor journalist with In These Times, and he joins us in studio.
Great to be in the studio, Rose.
It's great to see you in person. And we're joined by Lee Fong. He's a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. He covers money in politics and lobbying. He's author of The Machine, a field guide to the resurgent right. And we'll be talking about the coverage that we might be seeing in the coming weeks about right-wing front groups that are being formed to attack grassroots labor groups. And Lee is also in studio. Hi,
hey,
Lee.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Lee, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I actually liked the Chris Hayes interview and coverage of the Syria conflict. He's brought in a diverse set of voices to discuss the conflict. He's had the kind of moderate pro-Obama Democrats like Tom Perriello. He's also had Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman to come in and bring in very pointed questions that you don't typically see in the corporate media. So I appreciate those diverse set of viewpoints that he's brought on to it.
What about MSNBC overall? I don't really have to say I don't watch anymore, but what is that? What is their line on Obama and the strike on Syria? Are they asking the tough questions?
I think overall they haven't been. One interesting thing, you look at the conservative blogs that are dedicated to criticizing MSNBC, and they actually have some legitimate hits on MSNBC. One of them being, if you look at the MSNBC Facebook page, they have these memes, you know, these pictures with the white letters that kind of, you know, are created
ruining
to be viral.
Facebook.
Completely ruining Facebook. But they've been creating these memes over the past 3 days, you know, calling Obama bold, saying we've got to face this red line, and then asking people to share it. It's very propaganda-like.
Who's creating this?
MSNBC.
Really?
Yeah. So, I think anyone would be uncomfortable with a situation where a major media outlet is producing what looks like partisan propaganda for an administration to go to war. I mean, that's not the role of the media. Mm. That being said, it is nice to see folks like Hayes bringing in diverse viewpoints, I think asking critical questions. When you look at the media at large, you look at NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox News, CNN, you don't see these viewpoints, and you don't see the same type of discussion going on.
What about you, Mike? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
So I was on vacation, so I didn't follow a lot of news. But there was a great story that my friend Dave Jameson did over the Huffington Post on the dollar store, where he did, this was months of investigative work, where he went in and looked at how the dollar store was misclassifying workers as managers in order to get out to avoid paying them overtime. And, he dug through court records. He really tracked down people. And it was a pretty great story. And I thought that was a pretty great story this week. Also, I think my friend Susanna George has been doing a lot of great coverage over this new site, Syria Deeply. It's really great. Folks should check it out. So that's what I saw this week.
Syria Deeply?
Yeah, it's it's a new site on the Syria conflict, folks on the ground, has very interactive features, really great podcast. It's really good. People should check it out.
All right, we'll put a link to that after the show. What about you, Mark? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to tout one of our own reporters, Marissa Taylor, meaning a McClatchy reporter. And she has a fresh story today, which is part of a series that she's been doing on the role of polygraph and lie detector tests in national security efforts. Now, the story she's done today is really sort of a routine story, which is that a federal judge sentenced this morning to 8 months in prison an Indiana Little League coach who's been teaching government employees or potential government employees how to take lie detector tests, you know, how to breathe, how to, you know, if you're asked an uncomfortable question, how to respond and that sort of thing. He was accused of a crime, saying it's criminal conduct to tell people how to beat these tests. And I find it to be incredibly ironic that courts that will not accept the results of lie detector tests in as evidence because they're unreliable, have now sentenced to prison somebody who is teaching people how to beat an unreliable test. And there's something wrong there. It's just such an odd thing. If the courts don't accept that lie detectors are valid, and they don't as evidence, then how can you sentence somebody to prison for committing the crime of telling people how to take this unreliable test?
Hmm.
Anyway, it's part of a series she's been doing on this for a number of months now that I think most people probably haven't been following, but I know for government employees it's a very interesting set of stories.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because we've been meaning to have her on to talk about her story. So thank you for that. That is Mark Seibel. He oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondence, and you can find Marissa Taylor's piece on our website. So let's dive in here and talk about Syria. And I would like to give out the phone number because this is such a huge issue. And on Monday, we are going to have a more in-depth conversation about why the administration is so adamant about striking Syria. But if you have any thoughts or questions about media coverage, what really strikes you about the media coverage of this? Because it is getting 24/7 coverage. We've been here before. Who's keeping the administration accountable in light of what we know from the past attacks? What questions should the media be exploring? Where are you seeing good coverage of a possible strike on Syria? So, Mark, President Obama is really pushing for this. I mean, John Kerry, I don't think I've ever heard him sound so angry as when he testified earlier this week. But the president, he just canceled a fundraiser in California to make a case for striking Syria. He's going to talk to the country on Tuesday. The question I still have not heard many reporters ask is, why is he doing this?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. I mean, they will give you the answer that they're doing it because a red line has been crossed, that a moral position has to be defended, and they're trying to approach it from that standpoint. What has struck me about the media coverage, though, is how few of reporters that I ordinarily have lots of respect for have raised any skepticism about what the administration is saying. I was reading a piece last night by Steve Cole in The New Yorker that just accepts that 1,400 people died in the most recent chemical weapons attack. Well, we don't know that. The government has been certainly not transparent about how they arrived at a figure of 1,429, including 426 children. No other organization, not even the Syrian rebels, have given that number. And Kerry has not been asked at the congressional hearings, and that doesn't surprise me. But he has taken no questions from the media, and there has been no response to questions asked the State Department. Where did that number come from? Now, the French have said they think more than 281 people died in it, and they have told us how they arrived at that number. They looked at 47 videos from a number of areas, and they counted the bodies in them. But we don't get that kind of transparency from the United States. Kerry also really began his push for action in Syria with a statement that was false, and that was that a five-day delay rendered any kind of UN investigation invalid because the evidence would have been destroyed. Well, anyone who knows anything about chemical weapons displays investigations knows that 5 days is nothing. When we investigated Saddam Hussein's attacks at Halabja, that investigation by the Physicians for Human Rights came 4 years later, and they were still able to detect mustard gas and sarin and put together a pretty good view of what it was. So as soon as he came out on TV on that Monday morning a couple weeks ago and said, 5 days is too long, there's not going to be any evidence, you have to wonder, why did he say that? He's been around this stuff for years. Mm. He knows that's not true. So I think you have to become skeptical at the very beginning when you start your campaign with something that's demonstrably untrue. Now, if he'd come out and said, we don't think a UN investigation is necessary, we know everything we need to know, they're not going to contribute to our knowledge, okay, I can buy that. That may be true, and certainly it's their position now. But why do you start out with a statement that asserts something that's not true? Why can't you tell us how you know how many people died? Why can't you release the transcripts of these intercepted communications? We've already told them we intercepted the communications. That won't be a surprise. But when he was asked directly at a congressional hearing for those transcripts the other day, he responded, we're going to do that in a classified section. Well, why is that? Why don't we get to know? So I'm surprised that there isn't more skepticism on the part of journalists about the whole presentation, because I don't think it's been very transparent.
The LA Times did have a piece yesterday called U.S. Figure for Casualties in Syria Attack Much Higher Than Others. And I just want to give out the phone number if you'd like to talk about coverage of Syria. What's really struck you about coverage this week? Where are you seeing good coverage? And what have the media learned since Iraq and Afghanistan? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Before we get to calls, Mike or Lee, do you want to jump in here? I mean, what questions should the media be asking, and what have reporters learned from the past?
You know, I think these are some Mike. Excellent questions that have come up, and I think always as reporters we're taught to question official numbers, and I've quite frankly hadn't even heard that figure brought up. You know, I hear people like Chris Hayes throw around the 1,400 figure. And, you know, I know Chris and other people have brought up questions about what's the chain of command. Did Assad do this? Did some renegade faction do this? Did some rebels do this? And there's a lot of unanswered questions there. But, you know, just now thinking about this, about the violence and the strikes, I thought of that movie that came out, The Interrupters, the Frontline documentary about violence in inner city Chicago. And, you know, we talk about why we're going to strike Syria, and we talk about the idea that the Syrian, that Assad violated some great moral code by launching these chemical weapons, that he crossed a line and that we have to respond in order to keep our honor. And it reminded me of the scenes in the movie The Interrupters, which is the movie The Interrupters is about gang intervention counselors in inner city Chicago who go into violent situations and they get people to back down involved in different gangs or people that are involved in different cliques that are, you know, fighting with one another, and they get people to back down. And it sort of reminded me of that movie, because what winds up happening is that somebody gets insulted in one of these neighborhoods in inner city Chicago, and then they go and they shoot somebody in order to say, hey, we can't cross that moral code. And then what winds up happening is that somebody from that gang goes and shoots somebody else. So in some ways, I'm thinking about this thing in Syria, and instead of just saying, hey, you know, he crossed this moral line. It's almost like they're an inner city gang in Chicago. It's that we're going to go out and we're going to respond because our honor was hurt. And if we don't, you know, it's going to hurt our honor more. And repeating the same cycle. And I think about the movie The Interrupters, where they talk about violence as a contagious disease. And in this sort of situation, you have to ask yourself, is bombing going to help spread that disease or not? And I think the question is, I think it will help spread the disease. I think it will bring more allies and stiffen up the resistance of Assad. And is that the best thing as opposed to kind of cooling things off and forcing the sides to sort of mediate?
You know, I'm kind of interested in the Republican grassroots and rank-and-file response to the administration's call for missile strikes. I mean, if you listen to Justin Amash and some of these other kind of libertarian-leaning House Republicans, they're asking the question that reporters aren't. What's the end game? What's the strategy? It's the question that wasn't asked in the lead-up to the Iraq War, hasn't been asked in many of the other military interventions we've seen since. And that's actually the leading line of questioning from the Tea Party Republicans. What happens after the missiles launch? After they, you know, supposedly hit these weapon caches, what goes next, and what's the endgame strategy? And I think that's very interesting that that's now the dynamic, at least within this section of the Tea Party.
And these are mostly new politicians.
Yes.
Right? And the other thing I wonder about, and, you know, I'm obviously no chemical warfare expert. I'm a labor reporter. What happens when you bomb a sarin gas site? I haven't heard anybody answer that question.
See, that's the other thing is you you know. Right.
Does that release the gas, or does the gas burn up? Nobody's answered that question. Or, yeah. Are we just going to sort of just do something in order to show our moral code, like you're some inner city gang in Chicago?
Well, and also, Mark, what are your thoughts about the ease with which reporters are talking about bombing another country?
It has always fascinated me, and it has fascinated me more in the last few months. But for the last 2.5 years, it has fascinated me that reporters who cover Syria, by and large, bought into a narrative that was not actually true. And the narrative was this. Bashar Assad, now this part is true, Bashar Assad responded with force to peaceful demonstrators, and I think that's true, but then continued to attack civilian neighborhoods and civilian people and legitimate political activity for months, right up to February of 2012, where we were talking about the targeting of Baba Amr, a neighborhood in Homs. Well, the story that for most reporters never got told was that somebody was shooting back at the Assad forces every day. In the Syrian news media were lists of police officers and army soldiers and security troops who had been killed in confrontations with somebody, even going back to June of 2011, where there was an attack on our checkpoint outside of Jisr al-Shukr that killed 80 Syrian soldiers. Well, there was a civil war going on much earlier than we caught on to it. The artillery shelling of Baba Amr had to do with the fact that there were 150 members of the Farouk Battalion, which is a rebel force, a quite good one, that had occupied the neighborhood. They were in sandbagged emplacements. They had automatic weapons, and they were not a small group of people. And so, you know, I mean, U.S. military doctrine would have required an attack of 30,000 soldiers to uproot those 1,500 people. So it has not been a well-reported conflict from the beginning. And the excitement or the enthusiasm that journalists in general have shown for intervention, it's one reason they're just not asking any hard questions. And I think, you know, as you look for the motivation of what this is all about, I think you have to remember a couple of things. Let's not talk about Iraq as much as let's talk about Libya. Remember when we decided that we were going to join the no-fly campaign against the Gaddafi government, the idea that we were going to protect Libyan civilians from Libyan military. Fine, great idea. But the question we asked in the first story we did when that bombing began is, how can you begin a campaign against a government that's going to be only to protect civilians when you have announced that it's time for the head of that government to leave office? And the obvious answer was, you can't. Once you begin a campaign like that, you must follow it through to fruition. And that's exactly what happened with Gaddafi. Remember, it was a NATO airstrike that hit Gaddafi's convoy that allowed the rebels to catch him and ultimately execute him and force him from office. That wasn't, you know, so we talk about mission creep in Syria, but I'm very skeptical that there won't be mission creep in Syria, because we've already called for the downfall of Assad. We have for 2 years now. We're really going to be satisfied launching an attack? What happens if he wins this war? And I think that's really the issue here, because it's become very clear over the summer and in the spring that Assad's forces were on they were coming back. And the Israelis, the Germans changed their intelligence assessments last spring that Assad would fall. They changed it to say, no, Assad is going to survive. So I find it very interesting that now we're in a position where we're going to begin a military campaign in Syria. I think it's too coincidental.
That is Mark Seibel. He oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondence. Mike Elk is a labor journalist with In These Times. And Lee Fong is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Let's take a call. We've got a number of calls on this. So let's take one before break. Let's go to Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I think this urge to go attack Syria is not out of concern for Arab lives. If that was the case, they would have done something about the Palestinians who've been getting killed over, how many, I don't know, 40 years, or if not more. Mm. So this is, you know, that's just a nonsense cover for doing your ultra as your other agenda, okay? So I thought this president was smarter than he's turning out to be. He stumbles into stuff that he cannot finish, and then he wants a way out, and then he digs his hole deeper and deeper.
And Alex, just quickly, we're almost going to break. What do you think about media coverage?
Well, the media coverage is just, it's so sad, because they just get fed at the, you know, in Washington, D.C. Whatever they get from the D.C. is what they reflect. Then they have no original any coverage or anything. They just, it's filtered. It's filtered through the powers, period. You're not getting what they don't want you to get. I'm convinced of that.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, and we'll get some responses right after the break. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we will continue talking about media coverage of Syria. Again, a number of protests have taken place already across the country, not getting much attention. I've heard a lot of people, especially libertarians, say, where's the anti-war left? Well, it's fair to say that they're definitely not as big as they were under Bush, but about 50 protests are scheduled in the coming days. And we're talking about coverage of Syria, who's asking the right questions, and what questions should reporters be asking. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable on KALW 91.7 FM. All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted online at yourcallradio.org, and we invite you to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-TALK. Or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. KALW begins its fall membership campaign next Thursday, but like our recent campaigns, we'll do it with no interruption of our regular programming. In order for the campaign to be successful and for us to keep it to just 7 days again, we're asking you to make an early donation at KALW.org. All gifts received will count towards our overall goal. That's KALW.org. Thank you so much for making that possible.
The This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a more in-depth conversation about Syria. Why does the Obama administration want to attack? Who is in the coalition that supports intervention? Who opposes it? What are the implications of strikes? And what are the alternatives as Syria's civil war continues to deepen? And then Tuesday, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about how public transportation really does affect economic mobility. That's on Tuesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Mike Elk, labor journalist with In These Times. In a couple minutes, we'll talk about labor reporting and all of the protests we've been seeing recently. And Lee Fong is a reporting fellow with the investigative fund at The Nation. Mark Seibel oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondents. Mark, before we let you go, President Obama is going to speak to the nation on Tuesday, and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted to strike. When is the House expected to vote?
Well, there is no House vote set yet, and I think the president's speech is clearly timed to happen before that vote. It would not surprise me if that vote doesn't come till fairly late in the week.
Okay.
At this point, it's pretty clear that the House is very likely to reject it.
Right.
And so I think that Obama's speech is intended to convince Americans to call their House representatives and tell them to vote in favor of it, as well as an effort to convince members of the House. But it does not, if you were in favor of this vote, you would not be very hopeful in looking at the way the House is thinking right now.
Right. Representative Alan Grayson was on Democracy Now! Yesterday saying that the Dems oppose it by a ratio of about 4-1 and the Republicans oppose it by 10-1. And he thinks it's just going to fall flat.
Well, it's quite possible. I read something now. Our own figures don't match this, but I read something yesterday on Huffington Post that there are already 215 House members confirmed no's. Well, you only need 218 to have a majority.
Hmm.
So it could be quite overwhelming. At least it will, in any case, be probably as close as the NSA vote that the administration almost lost and was very much surprised by when the House almost killed funding for the NSA eavesdropping program.
Well, Mark, we'd love to have you back because it'll be interesting to see how the media decide to cover President Obama's speech on Tuesday night.
Well, whenever you need me, call me up.
All right. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thanks a lot.
That is Mark Seibel. He oversees McClatchy's foreign bureaus as chief of correspondents. Be sure to check out the piece he wrote with his colleague Hannah Alam, To Some U.S. Case for Syrian Gas Attack. Strike has too many holes. And I'm sorry we didn't get to take all of your calls on Syria, but definitely tune in on Monday because we'll spend the hour really talking about the players involved, why this is happening, what is the possibility for civilian casualties. I really haven't heard that brought up at all. It's almost like civilians don't exist when you bomb another country. But we'll definitely talk about that on Monday, so be sure to tune in and call in with your questions. So now we're going to talk about the state of labor reporting in the United States as we're seeing so many more workers protest and go on strike. Just yesterday, Walmart workers protested in 15 cities. There were at least 24 arrests. In New York City, there were 3 arrests. Workers are calling for a living wage and an end to retaliation. This follows the largest fast food protest the industry has ever seen. Mike, you cover labor closely for In These Times. What really strikes you about how the national media are covering these protests and strikes?
Well, it's twofold. I think, one, it's gotten a great deal of attention. And it's an interesting campaign in some ways by the unions because obviously they're trying to pass an increase in minimum wage. And instead of just giving money to Democrats, I think these strikes are helping to get the media to talk about this issue. So obviously it's getting a lot of attention. These are big national corporations that everybody knows, and they're getting a lot of attention. But the reporting's kind of shallow for a couple of reasons. I mean, it's all kind of human interest reporting, which is important in labor, but what are these companies? What are their corporate profits? What's preventing them from doing this? There's not a lot of reporting about what is the franchise structure of these places.
Mm.
And I think the reporting on the left on the fast food has been awful. I think the left media has abandoned its role of asking serious questions about where this organizing campaign is. And I think the person who's really amplified this is Josh Idelson. I think he's done a really bad job.
At The Nation?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
I feel so. I mean, he's basically taking the PR lines that the, you know, head of SEIU, Mary Kay Henry, is giving him and repeating them. There's not been a lot of questioning of what is the strategy here. And SEIU has said in this instance that they don't think they can win a traditional NLRB election. So basically, there's two ways that unions work, that you can win an election. One, you file a petition with the National Labor Relations Board, and they hold an election, and it's certified by the government. And the second way is sometimes with low-wage workers, some of these unions say, well, it's impossible to win at these fast food restaurants. The turnover is so high, they can just close one of these fast food restaurants. And, you know, they can just shut it down right away. And so it's not worth the effort of going through the NLRB. And so what they do is they try to cut these card check recognition deals, which is that they go to the corporation, they press the corporation for recognition, and then they say, you know, they press it for recognition. And typically what winds up happening is that the union, and SEIU has done this in a lot of cases, will pre-negotiate a contract before they even get a single worker signed up for the union. And so they'll get neutrality and they'll get card check recognition from the company. And we saw this at Sodexo, where SEIU was organizing. You know, Wall Street Journal did a great front page article by my buddy Chris Mayer out of the Pittsburgh Bureau. They did a story where SEIU went in and they pre-negotiated a contract with Sodexo. The contract was secret, not even the members who were being organized. So you got to ask yourself, why isn't SEIU going for a traditional NLRB election that doesn't mean cutting a sweetheart deal with a company? And these questions haven't been asked, especially by Josh. I mean, Josh has just taken the line, hook, bait, from the SEIU. And it's been pretty awful, in my opinion. It's journalistic malpractice, in my opinion. And the left media really, you know, because everybody, I think, who's reading The Nation, who's reading In These Times, thinks that fast food workers should get a living wage. So then we have to ask the serious question is, what are these workers doing? And, you know, Josh sort of brought up in one of his interviews, he interviews Scott Courtney, who's the chief of staff of SEIU, who should be in prison. Let's be perfectly honest. I mean, this guy's been double-dipping on salaries. This has been well-reported by my friend Steve Early and other people. This guy should be in prison, the chief of staff of SEIU. And he's been reporting in this instance that basically SEIU has said that basically they don't think they're ever going to unionize these workers, that either it's going to help them pass local living wage ordinances or cut some sort of agreement with the company. So what happens then to these workers that are actually going out on strike, risking their lives, risking their livelihood, potentially getting blacklisted? Mm-hmm. Are these folks just going to be thrown out? Because it doesn't seem like the workers here are really in the driver's seat. It seems like, you know, SEIU has this big plan from the top that doesn't really involve the workers driving it.
In order to
I don't think those questions have been asked. What's going to happen to these workers? Because I've seen so many SEIU campaigns where people just get cut off, and they're not being given any direction. And I think SEIU is a union that has shown throughout its history. I mean, here you have a union that is organizing low wage workers whose president is making $350,000 a year. So how in touch are these folks really with the folks they're organizing? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they have a history of corrupt deal making. I mean, the head of SEIU, Andy Stern, went to go work for the private equity firm with whom he cut a sweetheart deal. So there haven't been any questions on the left about what is the organizing strategy. And I think you could go with a traditional NLRB election with the franchise structure. I mean, you have franchises where you have 7 or 8 McDonald's in one region, and you could get the NLRB to say we're going to have an election at all 7 or 8. But SEIU doesn't want to do that. They don't want to put workers in the driver's seat. Hmm. And I don't think those questions have been asked.
Lee, what do you think?
You know, I can't speak to the particulars of what organizing strategy would work best for these low-wage, mostly fast food or retail jobs. As I understand it, unions have tried a lot of these industries, and because their high turnover rates, because of the kind of relationship between management and employees, that it's very easy to intimidate folks. They've put a lot of money into this traditional NLRB organizing efforts and failed over the last couple decades. So this is a new strategy that's being tried. Working with many different interest groups, working with civil rights, working with community organizing groups, working with the legal community to form these what's been called alt-labor worker centers, these foundations focused on not just unionizing folks. In fact, explicitly, that's not their goal. They're just raising kind of the consciousness of these workers around workplace issues, talking to community stakeholders about what workers go through and what their particular needs are. And so I can't speak to the organizing strategy, but I will say, let's look at this from a macro level. You know, we just had an August town hall season where you had members of Congress ask what appeared to be organic questions from town hall members about the minimum wage. What are you going to do about fast food workers who are making the minimum wage, don't have enough money to provide for their families, don't have basic benefits? You're seeing a spike in news coverage around these issues because of this type of organizing. You're seeing a drive towards pushing a higher minimum wage and state ballot initiatives across the country, and you're seeing momentum go forward. So I think this is very interesting. And I will say, again, and maybe this is a little bit shallow, but you look at the most popular news sources for Americans. You know, they're not the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. It's websites like Reddit and some of these other kind of Facebook social media sites, and some of the most popular items on these websites over the last couple months have been people on their own volition going and saying, look at what's going on at these restaurants, or look at what's going on at Walmart. This is what I experienced when I was working at the Olive Garden. Here's a picture and here's my personal story. People feel empowered when they see this type of activism. And I think on a macro level, that's a very good thing.
That is Lee Fong. He's a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, covering money and politics, conservative movements and lobbying. And Mike Elk is a labor journalist with In These Times. And if you'd like to join us to talk about media coverage of these protests and the strikes that we've been seeing across the country, and it sounds like they're just going to continue, what are your thoughts? And what about just the state of labor reporting? I mean, Mike, you brought up so many different layers of what happens with unions. And I mean, you have to be a labor reporter to understand how that works, right? And what goes on behind the scenes and who are the major players. And at this point, there's what, 3 full-time labor reporters in the country? Stephen Greenhouse with the New York Times. Yeah. I think there's someone at the Wall Street Journal, right?
Yeah, I mean, you have Melanie Trotman, Chris. You probably have about 15 to 20.
And they full-time labor?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them work at trade publications like BNA. So you have 2 at the Wall Street Journal, which, you know, Chris Mayer, I think, is one of the best in the country. Dave Jamieson at HuffPo is obviously the best feature writer in the country. You know, you have Sarah Jaffe, who writes it In These Times with me, David Moberg, semi-retired, semi-still working a good bit, Idelson. You know, you have Ned Reshkoff, who works at Reznikoff. I don't know how to say the guy's name, who works at MSNBC. So you have a dozen or so, and I think, you know, and obviously Steve Early, Jane Slaughter, doing stuff over at Labor Notes. But, you know, I think in the last couple of years it's been interesting because we've sort of seen a resurgence of some labor reporting on the left, especially in the wake of Wisconsin. When I came into the game, you know, around 2009, early 2009, when the Employee Free Choice Act was coming up, I was the only person under 35 on the beat. Now we have 5 of us full-time and under 35. But increasingly you're getting more of the news about labor from the left. And the left media does a bad job of asking tough questions of labor leaders. Mm. So it's like labor leaders can do no wrong. And, you know, labor leaders should be covered like any other elected official and ask tough questions. And I think in the situation of fast food strikes, we have workers risking their jobs and not having a say in how this is led. Those questions have not been asked. And I think, you know, some of my colleagues have done a really awful job on it, particularly on the left.
And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What changes have you seen, though? Because a couple weeks ago, the NewsHour had a debate about a minimum wage increase, and they had someone from the Center for American Progress and a Wall Street Journal op-ed columnist, conservative, who threw out the line about teenagers making minimum wage, and he wasn't challenged. But what I'm noticing is I'm looking at this Wall Street Journal column today by, gotta find this guy's name, Al Lewis. And he wrote, always the low price race to the bottom might be nearing its final laps. We remember when fast food jobs were for teenagers. Those days are gone. A recent analysis by the Economic Policy Institute shows more than 88% of workers making minimum wage are older than 20 years of age, mostly women, and they provide for their families. So it seems like that narrative is changing. That old narrative that it's all teenagers making minimum wage.
Yeah, I mean, I think While there are some concerns with the union leadership of SEIU, I think these fast food strikes have done two pretty interesting things. This one, they've introduced the concept of workers going on strike during an organizing drive, non-union workers going on strike. And we're already starting to see that spread. We saw Cablevision workers in Brooklyn do that. We saw some workers organizing with the IWW, with rail services outside of Chicago, do that. And in the Chicago instance, they were inspired to go on strike while organizing after another worker got fired. And they were able to keep the workers together by going on strike, and they eventually won that NLRB election, 17-15. And that's a new strategy that I think could help unions. Instead of waiting for the National Labor Relations Board to take a year maybe to correct an unfair firing, unions are going out on strike. So it gives them a little more leverage to fight back against the boss. But I do think it's really led to a big conversation on minimum wage and in an interesting way, as opposed to letting President Obama go around the country and stump and Thomas Perez, the Secretary of Labor, having workers out on the street has really created a narrative and I think a discussion about it.
I think it's you know, what keeps us docile in America? You know, there's very comfortable fantasies that I think a lot of Americans embrace and live through, even though, you know, if you go to McDonald's or you go to Wendy's, you see the truth. You know, it's not just teenagers, but there's kind of this conventional wisdom that hasn't been challenged in a very long time about these wages, about the type of demographic of worker that has these types of jobs. And it's kind of like the Arab Spring. You know, you look at kind of the birth pangs of that movement, and, you know, you see stories about how in Bahrain, folks were passing around Google Maps of satellite images showing the Khalifas and some of the ruling parties having these huge palaces that no one had actually seen before because they couldn't see beyond the palace walls. I mean, these kind of simple facts motivated people to join a social movement. And this type of statistic that you just mentioned, that 88% are not teenagers. They're, you know, some of them are middle-aged. Many of them are middle-aged. These facts are going viral on Twitter. Mm-hmm. If you look at just yesterday, my buddy Zed Jelani on Twitter challenging so many different Georgia Republicans because for some reason, I don't know, this is just a thing in Georgia, a lot of franchise owners of McDonald's are also state lawmakers, state senators and state representatives. Yeah, it's weird.
Huh.
So he was on Twitter challenging about how much they pay their own workers and how old they are. And you're seeing these type of stats go viral.
And McDonald's brought in $5.5 billion in profits last year. Its CEO Don Thompson makes almost $14 million a year. I noticed those statistics aren't usually in these stories about the workers,
but they're increasingly.
But they're starting
are.
To, yeah. to get but in
Bloomberg
there.
Bloomberg News has done several pieces on it.
And you talk about the Republicans in Georgia, Lee. You've also been looking at right wing front groups that are starting to go after these grassroots labor groups. I mean, we're not talking about like SEIU, but they see these workers putting their lives on the line and. What's the response going to be? And how's that being covered?
You know, in my new book I had come out earlier this year called The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, I talk about how when big business or very wealthy individuals see a challenge in the political system, when they see social movements or they see momentum towards reform, instead of directly attacking the issue, they will go to PR firms and think tanks that operate as kind of coin-operated attack machines. And we've seen over the past year this kind of growth in these alt-labor strategies, in the last couple of weeks, we're seeing the kind of right-wing machinery gear up to attack them. And so the National Restaurant Association is the big trade group for McDonald's, Darden Restaurants, which is Olive Garden and the like. They've been reaching out, hiring more lobbyists on the state level. And simultaneously, we're seeing groups like Rick Berman, this kind of infamous anti-union operative, sponsoring advertisements in the Wall Street Journal, calling out these worker centers, launching a new website in July. And maybe by some kind of coincidence, Darrell Issa, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, calling for an investigation of the Restaurant Opportunity Center, one of these alt-labor groups. And just this week, we have Littler Mendelson, this anti-union law firm, putting out a report laying out kind of the vulnerabilities of these worker centers. And Capital Research Center, now this is a very obscure right-wing think tank in Washington, D.C., also putting out a research memo how to go after these alt-labor organizations. And if you look in the last couple of years, if you look back in 2006, 2007, these are the exact same players who kind of galvanized the movement against ACORN. Capital Research Center laid out about a dozen research memos on the vulnerabilities of ACORN, how you could get them on racketeering, how you could prosecute them on the state level for some of these voter registration drives, laying out just all kinds of ideas to pose to Republican lawmakers, to the bigger think tanks like Heritage and the American Legislative Exchange Council, how they can go after these folks. And like I said, in the last 5 days, we're seeing these reports, we're seeing this momentum, and some of these large companies are reconfiguring their PR strategies. Walmart recently hired Steve Bartlett, the Bush kind of PR mastermind, to replace Leslie Dock, and they've reshuffled as they kind of realign for this new movement.
What is involved in tracking all of this and keeping up with it, and is this getting attention? I mean, is it easy to find these documents?
Well, this is my job.
Thank you for doing your job, Lee.
I cover lobbying and right-wing movements because I'm kind of an obsessive. But some of this is obscure because the whole point of, I think, a lot of the conservative movement is to obscure what the real motivating factors are. Who's paying them to do so? Who are the lobbyists? Why they're doing this? I mean, they like to cloak a lot of these tactics in, you know, obscure or ambiguous terms like, oh, we need to stop the union agenda. They came up with a term in one of these memos that came out this week. Let's call these UFOs, union front group organizations, and kind of make them seem spooky, right? I don't think that's going to work. But
it'll be fun.
But, you know, this is what they do. They're hired to obscure that McDonald's and Darden restaurants want this goal. They want to make it a conservative left-right issue and polarize it like they've polarized climate change, like they've polarized a lot of these bank regulation issues. They've polarized health reform. And they want to now polarize these alt-labor strategies.
And, you know, I think there's something interesting that Lee brings up here. You know, Chris Hayes did a segment, I think, last week on the fast food workers, and he brought up something I always found interesting. Is that, you know, I've stopped debating union busters on TV, and I refuse to do it. You know, if somebody from Boeing or somebody from General Electric or somebody from Honeywell wants to come on and debate me on TV, I'll do it. I'm not going to debate some right-wing front group. They got no skin in the game. They got no credibility. And what Chris brought up is that, you know, they invited representatives of McDonald's, these other fast food chains, to come on the air and talk. And they won't do it. But instead, what we see so much in the media is what Lee's saying when we're covering workers. They make this left-right polarization as opposed to hero workers in a corporation. So you have on a union guy or somebody who's sympathetic or a Democratic strategist, and then you have on somebody from some front group, which, quite frankly, I don't care. I think it's journalistic malpractice to have on somebody from a front group. They got no skin in the game. You know, you got to read one of Lee's articles to find out who they even represent. But, you know, they should, quite frankly, a lot of TV hosts should put up an empty chair and say, hey, today we are talking about McDonald's wages, and McDonald's will not speak. And I think Chris brought up a good point about this, and I think it's absurd that we allow these front group guys to go on TV.
Mike Elk is a labor journalist with In These Times, and Lee Fong is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at The Nation. We've got time for a call. Let's hear from Tom in Alameda. Hi, Tom. Thanks for holding.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I wonder if the panelists can discuss a little bit about youth employment and young workers and how they're generally dismissed and taken for granted, not just by big corporations, but also by big labor organizers, the top-down organizers, because I want to hear a parallel made a little bit about how young people in this country being hired by very low-wage and labor-abusive corporations like McDonald's. And SEIU basically not really interested in these people. And I want to talk about...
And, you know, I'm sorry to cut you off. We only have a couple minutes left, so do you want to quickly respond to that, Mike?
Yeah, I think, you know, a number of unions have tried to do young worker programs over the last couple of years. I think the steelworkers have done a successful one. But it really requires putting people in the driver's seat. And a lot of these unions, you know, you have folks that fight for decades to get to the top in these ugly battles, don't want to do that. So they want to reach out to young workers, but the only way you're going to revive the labor movement is to really put the rank and file back in the driver's seat.
And the unemployment rate for youth is pretty high in this country.
Yeah.
We've got just a couple minutes left. Someone wanted to point out that Chris Hayes does bring on front groups.
Oh, he does?
MSNBC. On people from front groups.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. And I think a lot of TV bookers do it because it makes for interesting TV having a debate. Or you know who that guy I really hate who's on TV, that Josh Barrow guy? He's a Business Insider. He shouldn't be allowed on TV. He's a hack. No, seriously. I was on TV debating like workplace deaths and like with this guy. And I'm like, this guy knows nothing. I've spent like 4 years of my life covering like interviewing families. This guy read some snarky Matt Iglesias post and he's going to be on TV with me? Like, no. Like, this is an insult to my intelligence to be on TV with Josh Barrow.
Lee, before we end, I just want to ask you, where can we read about these new front groups and the attacks that are being planned right now?
Well, thank you for having me on again, Rose. I'm now motivated to blog a little bit more on this. But these corporations face very few statutory obligations to disclose. So a lot of it's kind of piecemeal, putting together the lobbyists, the PR firms, and the various foundations that make up this kind of right-wing infrastructure, and tracing it back to these corporations is difficult, and I'd like to do more.
All right, good. So we'll look for your report. And Mike, just quickly, what are you working on right now?
I'm working on a big series on asbestos removal workers and how often they don't have proper safety protections because so many of them are undocumented workers.
Mm. Mike Elk is a labor journalist with In These Times, and Lee Fong is a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at The Nation. Check out his book, The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you, Rose.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Why does the Obama administration want to attack Syria? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the administration's intensified lobbying campaign to win support for its plans to strike Syria. Who's in the coalition that supports intervention and who opposes it? What are the potential implications of a U.S. strike? And what are the alternatives as Syria's civil war continues to deepen? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Eric Jansen is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI. Debate over U.S. military action in Syria dominated Congress this week. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, independent, shares his views with us. Princeton psychologist Elder Shafir tells us why poverty literally makes it hard to think. And jazz guitarist Earl Klugh discusses his new CD, Handpicked, on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
Tavis Smiley Show at noon here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow.
The planet spins, tales unfold, and emotions rise and fall. This is Michael Lasser. Join me for fascinating rhythm and songs as the world goes round.
Just like Humpty Dumpty, I'm going to fall. I'm sitting on top of the world.
Fascinating rhythm tonight at 9 o'clock here on 91.7. BBC World Have Your Say is next.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Nuala McGovern. Is there a Cold War brewing?
As different as our perspectives may be, myself, Mr. Putin, and others are willing to set aside those differences and put some pressure on the parties on the ground.
There's been rhetoric, name-calling, PR offensives, and posturing between Russia and the United States. Well, the latest and most serious disagreement is over military intervention in Syria. And some say if a strike does go ahead, it could also be the beginning of a new Cold War. Former and current diplomats are here to speak with you. Get in touch with them at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Also this hour, we go to Buenos Aires. The International Olympic Committee are there gearing up for a secret ballot tomorrow to decide the host city for the 2020 Summer Olympics.